Okay, so today, at least the first part. Oh, unplug something. We'll come back. Okay, so for this this second lecture, I'll go through some experimental techniques. So again, it's kind of an overview of what we do, and I've picked a recent Atlas analysis as an example. So this is the Higgs decay to two W bosons. It's a challenging analysis that makes use of many different techniques and strategies for background estimations. So if you want all the details, it's in this paper. It's a long paper. The internal documentation for this analysis has over 1,000 pages. And so you'll see a few plots, but it's a lot of work. So the group that worked on this had, at the time of the discovery, about 130 people who did some work, and maybe there were 40 that were working on this nonstop. So some of the slides that you will see are from my colleague Corinne Mills, who was in charge of this group as of last March. Okay, so in principle, when we do these, hi, thank you. When we do these analyses, we'd like to keep all the events that we can, of course, because I mean, the machine, as you saw, is expensive. The detector is expensive. Everything's expensive. We'd like to keep everything we can, but unfortunately, we have to make pretty tight selections on specific objects to reduce backgrounds, as you will see. Now, this Higgs W analysis involves many things that have to do with reconstruction, background rejection, etc., including how to, techniques to reduce fake electrons, fake muons from QCD, jet reconstruction, pileup mitigation for jets. As we saw yesterday, you can get lots of particles that are produced in other collisions, and they will contaminate the jets that you're interested in. B tagging, so identifying B quarks, and also vetoing, so making sure that this jet does not have B quarks, which is important to reject top background. Jet vetoing, so in this case, it's making sure that there are no other jets. Again, it's to reduce the top background that's everywhere. Missing ET reconstruction that I will discuss a little bit later. So this is the missing momentum. So in an event, in this case, where we will have two neutrinos, we will have missing momentum, and so we want the best reconstruction possible. Again, it's difficult in a high pileup environment. And then how we go about selecting various features of this particular topology. So we characterize the events in terms of the number of jets that we see, in terms of the angles of the various particles, as we'll see in a second. And then how we use control and validation regions to normalize our backgrounds using the data. So you don't totally rely on calculations or Monte Carlo simulations, but you actually use the data to normalize the background and also check the modeling, use of multivariate techniques, etc. Okay, so why are we worried about fake electrons? So at a hadron collider, you're smashing hadrons. And so the strong force is strong, so most often you get jets, and you get lots of them. And so what this shows here is the cross-section, and you'll notice there's a little wiggle here, right? So it goes from 10 to the 6 to 10 to the 11. So there are five orders of magnitude that are squeezed here. So we can take a look at what it looks like, right? So the top one is the inelastic cross-section. So this is just the cross-section for breaking up the protons, if you will. And then at about close to 10 to the 6, you have the cross-section for producing jets. And this is a jet of 100 GV, which, you know, 10 years ago was enormous. And you see the difference between that. When you have a jet, you'll have another one. So it's like a die jet. And the processes that we're interested in, right? So many orders of magnitude. So what can happen is that you will get, say, a double, W here is the cross-section. That's the total cross-section. That's the cross-section for getting a jet. And so this is the difference, the relevant differences, if you want. Okay, so we need to make sure that those jets don't look like an electron, or are not that the electrons are not really jets. And I have a slide on that in a second. So this is the same slide, but maybe I'll discuss it this afternoon in more detail, because you see beautiful measurements everywhere. Okay, the three slides on Higgs production and decay, I'll talk about this more tomorrow. But this is just to put into context the analysis that we will look at. So the Higgs boson is produced through four different, or you could say five different production mechanisms at the DLHC. The dominant one is called gluon fusion. So you take two gluons from the protons, and in this loop you will have all the colored fermions, because this is a gluon. But it's dominated by the top loop, because the top is heavy, and the Higgs likes heavy particles. So most of it involves the top quark, at least in the standard model. And then it's followed by the weak boson fusion, or vector boson fusion process, where you have a quark from, and an anti-quark from the incoming protons. They emit a W pair, and these will fuse to produce a Higgs. And these quarks here will continue in the forward direction. So basically you have the quarks, they emit a W, they get a little bit of a kick, and they continue in the forward and backward directions. And the third and fourth processes are the associated production of a vector boson and a Higgs. And you see it here. So you have the Higgs and the WRZ boson. And the last one is quite small, because it requires a lot of energy to produce, for one thing. You have two top quarks and a Higgs boson. Okay, so we've looked for all these processes, and today I'll mostly discuss these two for the decaying question. So at a mass of 125 GV, which is the mass that we've measured, we're kind of lucky because we can observe many decay modes. So here you have the full range from 1 TeV to 100 GeV. And had the Higgs mass been around 300, we would not have been able to measure any of this, right? We would be stuck with W and ZZ. But in the range, if we zoom in to 125, in that range, we have access to many different decays. So we have BB bar, WW, gluon is two jets, we won't see, tau tau, and then gamma gamma is small, but we see it. And there are others that we will eventually see, like decay to two muons. Muons are light, and so the branching ratio is quite small, but in the next few years we should be able to see it. So one thing to notice here is that the branching ratio, the dominant branching ratio, is 2 BB bar, and the second one is WW. So we expect a lot of W bosons to be produced, and in fact, we have reconstructed hundreds. The analysis that involves BB bar is quite challenging, because this is two jets. It's very difficult to pull out a signal that has two jets at a hadron collider, if the process that you're interested in is fundamentally weak. Okay, so this is the branching ratio for two W bosons, but then we want to look at them into leptons, for the reason that I just mentioned, is that leptons are electroweak, are electroweakly produced. Okay, so so what are the advantages of this decay? So it has, like I said, a large branching ratio to WW. We have many signal events, which is good. However, the final state features neutrinos that we will not be able to reconstruct. And also with a mass of, 125, one of the two W bosons has to be off shell or virtual. Okay, which means that this lepton here at the bottom will be kind of soft, so have low PT. And the reason why this is a problem is that our fake rates increase as you go to lower PT. And I'll show you some plots of this in a second. So I mentioned that you can't reconstruct the final state neutrinos. And so what we use, the main discriminant, is this what we call a transverse mass, where we use the information that we do have and reconstruct a mass for the Higgs. Okay, so it's not like an invariant mass. If we had like in the ZZ final state, you have access to the full kinematics, and so you can reconstruct the mass of the Higgs. In this case, we can't. So it's wider and not necessarily, well, I'll show you what it looks like on this plot. So this is the transverse mass for the Higgs. It will not necessarily peak at 125, but it you can distinguish it from other processes. So you can see what the challenge is here with this analysis, is that you have some signal. It's not certainly not overwhelming, and you have a bunch of backgrounds, and you have many different backgrounds. Okay, so you have the continuum WW here. And here you have the fake electrons or muons that I mentioned before. You have diboson production, other dibosons like WZ, W gamma, W gamma star. You have the top background in yellow, and then Drellian in green. And you need to understand the normalization of all of these. Not just the normalization, but also the shape, because you're relying on the shape, on this shape, to extract your signal. So you need to be able to make sure that all of them are well understood, and that you have the proper systematics. At the end of the day, if you do a background subtraction, then you see that you have a nice peak here, and you see that you have hundreds of events, hundreds of Higgs candidates here. Yep. No, we have actually we've looked at all the productions, but in what I will discuss today, we'll see VBF, vector boson fusion, and gluon production. Okay, so here are what the main backgrounds look like. I mentioned WW before, so this is almost irreducible. It's this, exactly the same final state as the Higgs signal. The top background is reducible because the W's decay essentially 100% of the time to a W and a B quark. And so we expect the WW, which is in principle irreducible, but then there are two extra jets here, okay? So we can try to reduce the background just by asking for zero jets, for instance. However, the cross-section for TT bar production, it's a strong process, is enormous. It's much larger than the Higgs. And so occasionally you will have these jets will be below your threshold. So you will not see them. And so the top will enter in any case. Another background we need to deal with is W plus jet. So this is the production of one W and say a quark here that will eventually fake a lepton. As you saw, the cross section for this is very large. So it's quite rare that a jet will look like an electron. It's quite rare, but on the other hand, this is the production rate is very large. So these two factors compete with each other. We have other processes like Drellian, so the production of a Z or a virtual photon, and it can decay to two tau leptons. And this also has a similar final state, right? So you cannot count the number of neutrinos. You just know that you've got missing momentum. And so what you see is missing momentum and two leptons. And so this is a background you need to worry about. There's also this background where there are no neutrinos. So here you will need fake missing momentum in your detector to generate, to pass the selections. And I have three other backgrounds that I will show you later that are not shown here, but WZ, this would give you three leptons, so you need to lose one. And here it's the same thing. So the gamma here would convert to an electron, a leading electron. And normally you have pair production, so you expect two electron and a positron to come out, but sometimes you lose one. And so you will have a good legitimate lepton, missing transverse energy from the decay of the W, and an extra lepton.
What is your best production channel out of all of them? I mean, you have the leading jets and the forward and vector boson fusion, so it's not very much.
Yeah, well, it will change as a function of time because this is cleaner. The signal to background is much better here, but we do not have enough a lot of stats. So right now we get our best measurements from this one. Our cleanest final state would be this production with ZZ. But we predict one event in run one, and we've seen one. We have like one candidate. So it's not much. If we had infinite statistics, then this would completely swamp. The decay to ZZ, because you have a complete reconstruction. You can measure the mass of the Z, measure the mass of the W. Nevertheless, this is interesting, as you'll see tomorrow. I'll get back to this, but here you're measuring a coupling to Ws and Zs. So it's not just Ws here. You can have two Z bosons. So you're making a measurement of the couplings at the production end, and then this thing will decay, and you have another coupling. And so everything, all of this goes into a massive fit where we try to extract couplings, and we'll discuss
that. So are there different analyses for every single one, or is it one big analysis for every single production channel?
There's a different analysis for pretty much every different topology. So a group worked on this, a group worked on this just for WW, and for Ws going to leptons. And this one is also subdivided into many categories. I'll show you tomorrow. Okay. All right, so muons and electrons. So as we saw yesterday, muons, what we're looking for is a nice track that we see in the inner detector, so in the central spectrometer, and then a track that continues into the muon spectrometer. Okay, so those two segments, they should match. So we have a way of combining the two and making sure that they match well. The muons need to be isolated, so both in the calorimeter and the tracker. So what we mean by that is we look at our muon candidate, we draw a cone around it, and then we count the number of tracks above a certain threshold. And then we look at the calorimeter, and we again draw a cone, and we want that the energy in the calorimeter to be less than a certain amount. Okay, so if you have a real jet, it's going to be very hard for that jet that's producing like a shower of particles to basically fragment into, say, a leading B hadron, and then this B will decay to a muon. Or in the case of an electron, you could have, for instance, the production of pi zeros. If you remember, pi zeros decay to two photons. The photons can convert in the detector and produce an electron. But generally, the jet has many other particles. There will be charged pions, protons, neutrons, etc. And so you need a very, very special fragmentation where you basically have, say, a leading pi zero, and one of the photon converts, and there's very little activity. So this happens, but it's very rare. But the more we tighten the selection criteria and the isolation, the cleaner a sample we get, but then we start throwing away good events also. Okay, so muons need to be isolated. Now, the muon is supposed to be a minimum ionizing particle in the calorimeter, so we want to make sure that there's not a lot of energy around that track. And also importantly, the impact parameters should be small. So if, unfortunately, I forgot to put the, maybe I'll use the board if I can. So if you have one leading source of fake muons will come from the decay of heavy flavor quarks. And so the lifetime, say, of a B quark is such that when you reconstruct tracks, so you have the beam pipe, and then you have these concentric layers of tracking, right? And so you'll see a hit somewhere. Maybe I'm not doing well, that's okay. Okay, and so you'll reconstruct a track like this, and another it might look like this. And another one like that. Okay, so this is an example, for instance, of two tracks that would be reconstructed to be consistent with the primary vertex in the center of the beam pipe. So this is the beam pipe, and the collisions are happening. The beam is going through the board, particles are coming out in a transverse direction here. Okay, so, but if you have some particle that was coming here and it decayed, right? So you will have other tracks that do not cross the primary vertex. So we will have a secondary vertex. So if the particle has some lifetime, we can reconstruct this lifetime, or the distance, if you will, between a primary and a secondary vertex. And that can be significant. All right, so if we're dealing with a muon from the decay of a B, then it's quite unlikely that the impact parameter, which is the distance between, the closest distance between a primary vertex and a track, it's unlikely that it will be very small. It should be relatively large. Okay, so if tracks are prompt, they come from the primary interaction, the impact parameter should be small. So we make that requirement. And right, okay, so now for electrons, what we want is a cluster of energy in the EM calorimeter that we combine with an inner detector track. So we want a track that's pointing to this calorimeter cluster. The momentum and the energy should match. So we have a measure of the energy from the calorimeter, momentum from the track. And that should match. The isolation in the calorimeter and tracker, just like the muons. The shower shape, so we have a highly granular electromagnetic calorimeter. If you remember from yesterday, this animation, you could see all the structure of the electrode, so we can determine very, very well the shape of this shower, both transversely, but also as in depth. And so we want the shower shape to be consistent with that of an electron. If it's a charged pion, it should look quite different. If it's coming from two photons, it would also be different. And also the impact parameter, again, here should be small.
If you don't satisfy one of these criteria, one or more, so do you throw out the electron or do you throw out the
electron? The event. Well, it depends. So in the selection, you want two good leptons. Okay, so if this doesn't make an electron, then it will be called something else, right? So if this object has 50 GeV, then it would probably be classified as a jet then. And so it would be an event with two good leptons and a jet.
And if you have some kind of weird object that you have no idea what to do with it in the event, do you throw out the event? Like, it doesn't satisfy any sort of sensible criteria for electron muon, what do you do with that object?
I'll come back to this for the missing transverse momentum, but in principle, it would be treated as a jet. And we try to identify it as some object that we know. We do some jet reconstruction, but we have thresholds for that. And then we're left in the calorimeter with lots of energy deposits that we need to deal with. And And then those are calibrated to the energy of the clusters. So individually, you can look at the clusters and how they look like. Does this look like an EM cluster from a photon, an electron, or is it more like a hadronic cluster? And those clusters will get a certain energy calibration associated with them, and we will take care of them in the missing transverse momentum calculation. So these fake backgrounds pretty much drive the lepton selection. So there's always a tension, like I mentioned, between the efficiency and the suppression of the background from fake and non-prompt leptons. And this is just to make the point again. So the cross-section times branching ratio for what we're looking at is 0.2 picobarns, and this is the cross-section for producing a W. Okay, jets and B-tagging. So when you have a final state with quarks and gluons, they will eventually hadronize and produce a jet of colorless particles or hadrons. And so we need to identify this jet as either in a tracker or in the calorimeter. We can look at charged particles. We will not see neutrals in our tracker, but we will see the energy of neutrals in our calorimeter. Now, the thing about jets is they're not like an object, like an electron. An electron is, well, we know what we're talking about. It's a fundamental particle. But a jet is depends on the definition that you have. So it depends on your algorithm and how you select the inputs. Okay, and now the hadrons that contain heavy quarks, as I mentioned before, will travel some distance in a detector, typically in a beam pipe, in fact, and can be identified by the displaced tracks and the decay vertices. Okay, and you can again select we have different operating points or efficiencies where you can be very efficient at detecting B jets, but then your background is very large. Or you can be, this could be 50% efficient and your background is very small. Okay, so a word about jets. So what we want in terms of requirements for a good jet algorithm is we want it to be infrared safe, collinear safe, invariant under boosts, and easy to compare with theory. So I'll show you in the next slide what we mean by infrared safe and collinear safe. Invariant under boost seems a little bit obvious, on my previous experiment many years ago, our jets were not. So you want to construct Lorentz invariant quantities. And more importantly is that when you decide to go with a certain definition of the jet, you want to be able to easily compare with theory. So the theoretical calculations, they will not go very deep in this parton shower, right? So you start with a parton, and then you have a parton shower, and then hadronization. So the calculations will stop at the few emissions, and you want to be able to go from the final state, which will be calorimeter, say, level jets, to the calculation easily and minimize systematics. There are also experimental considerations, as you will have. You would like your jet algorithm not to depend on your detector configuration. So a good algorithm should work well on CMS and Atlas and anywhere else. You want it to be easy to calibrate. I'll come back to that in two slides. You want it to be robust under pileup and the underlying event. This is particularly true at Hadron Collider. If you're at E plus E minus, you would probably not really care, collider. And you want it to have high reconstruction efficiency. So you want to be able to, if you have a 25 GeV initial parton, you'd like to be able to reconstruct a jet out of that as often as possible. So what do we mean by infrared safety? Have you seen any of this yet in your? Okay, so it's been covered, the jets. Okay, so you know what I mean. Again, 15 years ago, our jet algorithms did not were not infrared safe or collinear safe. But you want your jet to be robust against soft emissions or collinear emissions. You don't want the jet topology to change because of soft effects or collinear effects. Have you seen the KT algorithm?
Yeah.
All right. That we don't use. So what we use is essentially anti-KT. There's nothing wrong with KT in principle, but this one is more robust against pileup, and this is illustrated here. So KT, the problem with KT is that it has irregular shapes, as you can see. So these are jets reconstructed with KT, and those are jets reconstructed with anti-KT. Before we were using KT and anti-KT, we were just using fixed cone algorithms, which didn't have the nice properties that I mentioned before. But the reason we were using fixed cone is that we could easily calculate the average energy from the underlying event or pileup because it's fixed, right? So you can go away from the jet and make a measurement of the overall activity in the event, and you know what to subtract from your jet. And so the fact that KT is regular and looks like a cone is an advantage. Okay, so missing transverse energy is basically the missing momentum. So after, it's the most complicated object, in fact, that we have because it's the last thing in principle that you calculate. So you look for your electrons, your muons, your taus, your B jets, the jets, and calculate the missing momentum in the transverse plane, and you need to calibrate for all of these objects, and whatever is missing is the missing transverse energy. Then you can assign this missing transverse energy to neutrinos or the vectorial sum of all the particles that you do not detect. Those could be dark matter particles, if we're lucky. In the past, we were using only the calorimeter to make this measurement, essentially. But now, with a lot of pileup, the calorimeter is always lit up. And so the resolution of this quantity, you know, if you do just a mathematical calculation, there's no resolution. I mean, when you have a real detector, sometimes you will have fluctuations. You're just mismeasuring the energy in your detector. And when you're adding a lot of noise from many different particles, then the resolution's worse. So at some point, when you start adding pileup, you cross a point where you're actually starting to do better by using tracks. So you're missing a lot of neutrals here. So you're sacrificing a bit of information. But on the other hand, you can pinpoint all the tracks that are coming from your vertex of interest and neglect everything else that's going on. Okay, I think this is illustrated here. So this is the in an environment with a lot of pileup, the blue curve shows you the PT, missing PT, missing momentum from the tracks, and the ET misses from the calorimeter, and you see that we get a much better resolution from the tracks. And this is from the decay of the W, so this is a reconstruction of the transverse mass for the Higgs, and you see that things are, well, have a better shape with the PT miss. So this was an innovation. Now, one thing that we do in our analyses is we don't look at the data, the signal data, where we think there'll be signal right away. And so this is a plot from the PDG. Why do we blind? So what you can see here are some measurements as a function of the year. And what you see is quite disturbing, right? Everyone is measuring some quantity, then whoops, it jumps. And then you keep measuring the same, and then it jumps again. And eventually it settles. And you see this for many different measurements, right? So the people here, I don't think were intentionally biased, but there's always a, when you make a measurement and you look at what comes out, if it's what you expect, you stop looking. If it's not what you expect, then you start working. And then if you were actually measuring, do we have a hockey stick here? Yeah, okay. So maybe this is actually what you measured here. This guy, this measurement here was maybe here when it came out with that size of error bar, but then they thought, okay, we're off, something's wrong. And so you start to do some tests, and the minute that you do a test where this jumps up, it must be right. You've just fixed your bug, right? And so we want to avoid these kinds of biases. People can be, for instance, when we measure the Higgs, we know what to expect. The standard model is quite predictive. And if there are deviations, we don't want to be influenced by what we expect. And so we blind our signal region. And then we start looking around that signal region to make sure we understand the background. And once we're convinced that we understand the backgrounds, we ask the collaboration to let us open the box, look at the signal. But until this is everything looks good, then we don't. So in my 5 minutes of of lateness, we were looking exactly at an unblinding approval. So we're looking at what I was doing in the hotel, looking at all the plots and making sure that everything looks good. Because once we unblind, I mean, if you find a bug, when you unblind, you find a bug, but it's very difficult then to change, right? If you don't like the answer, that doesn't work, right? You need to find a real bug. So how do we do the blinding for this analysis? It depends on your analysis. Sometimes it's very easy to do, sometimes it's harder. So in this case, we look at regions where the signal to background is less than 2% that we expect, okay? So we would be biased if the signal was very, very, very large, but if it's twice or three times the size that we expect, it won't make much of a difference. Now we had a problem when we were looking for the Higgs before we found it, is we didn't know the mass, and it's almost impossible to blind this analysis for all Higgs masses, because as you'll see, the signal then would, what we call a control region or a region where we evaluate the background, could contain signal. But we had indirect measurements and other channels that told us that, okay, it has to be in this range. So we blinded this range, a given range. So we went to the low mass range in the end. Then we defined our signal region in terms of these quantities that I'll discuss in a minute. So this is not necessarily important, but you need to basically figure out where your signal will be and where you will be allowed to look. Beforehand, people agree on the blinding procedure, and then you start your analysis. Yeah.
My understanding was of these kind of things that if you unblind and the result does not agree with the standard model, then you just keep applying all these kind of tests to see whether this is real and all this kind of stuff anyways at the end. Can you comment on the adult procedure for this sort of thing? Suppose you see an excess or deviation from the standard model, what is the procedure after unblinding?
We're still a bit biased, because if something comes out and it's 3 sigma, then the level of scrutiny is higher than if it. So we're not completely. We don't avoid this bias completely, but if when you go back, you say this. I did the analysis. Everything looks fine. Then people can ask for additional tests, and it will happen even if the result is right. I mean, to be honest, there's still a bit of bias. We won't put out a 4 sigma result just because we just saw 4, it just goes out like that. Then everybody, and by everybody I mean 2,000 people, will look at it if it was very significant. And when you have 2,000 eyes, then you get lots of questions, and then you need to answer them. We try as much as possible to avoid bias. Okay, what was the definition of Feynman science? Is a way of trying not to fool yourself, and we're trying not to fool ourselves as best we can, but it's not a perfect not a perfect thing. Sometimes we unblind and we see some excess or something wrong, not necessarily an excess, but you see right away that it's because of our blinding criteria, we were blind to some mismodeling that all of a sudden we see. We know it's not signal, we just screwed up somewhere. So it will happen sometimes. So the basic selection for this event, starts with two charged leptons, electrons or muons, and missing transverse energy from the neutrino. So it's pretty simple. It's two objects plus missing transverse energy. And so then we start to break this analysis into various categories. Okay, so we try to categorize events by the dominant signal and background, but also by the number of jets to separate top from gluon-gluon signal and VBF from gluon-gluon fusion, and then by lepton pair flavor, EE or mu mu. Okay, because EE and mu mu has a lot of Drellian. So we can look at what it looks like here. So these are four electron muon leptons. In zero jet, you see that you have quite a bit of Drellian. The blue here is WW. You have a little bit of top because it's hard for top to produce no jets when there are two somewhere. And the signal is underneath here. And the minute you go to one jet, you see that the top background explodes and two jets, then it's the top topology, right? So, however, I mean, if you wanted to do the cleanest possible analysis, you would just stick to this bin here. But there's lots of signal here. Also, because if you remember, this gluon-gluon fusion process will emit gluons. So it emits jets quite often. So we don't want to lose those events. They're not as clean, but we use them anyway. And here you see the problem when you have EE and mu mu, is that the Drellian, the Z, will decay exactly to this. And in zero jet, it's enormous. Now, this process does not have missing ET. So you need to... What you're getting is fake missing ET here. So you need to either increase it or find a way to improve your resolution as we did. Okay, so this is an example of the categorization. So the pre-selection is essentially the muons and the missing ET. And then we divide the analysis in various categories. For jet equals zero, we have a category for different flavor leptons and same flavor leptons. They have different backgrounds and purities, and jet equals one do the same thing. You go to greater than two, then you have VBF enriched, because in this production process, you expect two jets, and again, you split it up, and you can have a GGF enriched. You have two jets, but they're inconsistent. The jets are not going backward and forward, basically. So this one is particularly not pure, but we try to get a little bit of signal out of that. So the topological selections includes cuts on MLL, PTLL, and the angle between the two leptons. I think I have did I miss it? I'm missing one slide. I skipped it in the beginning. Okay. Maybe I'll just show you the... So, in principle, this Higgs is supposed to be a scalar. So it has spin zero, and you have two W's that come out. The W decays through the V minus A, V minus A interaction. And so if you want to conserve spin and you have V minus A, you end up with a topology where the two charged leptons are going in the same direction and the two neutrinos are going in the opposite direction. So we take advantage of this in our selections. So we expect the angle between the two leptons to be small. We expect the invariant mass of the two leptons to be small because the angle is small, but also because one of them will be a virtual W, and so the one is a bit softer or has less transverse momentum. And right, so these are the two main variables. And then we also have the PT of the lepton system. We want it to be large. So if we have, and the reason is that it's bouncing off those two electron, two neutrinos. And so the two particles will be boosted. If you didn't have neutrinos, and this was a Z boson that's decaying to an E plus E minus, they will be back to back. They will not be, they will not have PT. Okay. So that explains the those topological selections.
Sorry.
Yep.
So during the blank phase, all these backgrounds are determined from simulation?
No, from the data. Yeah. I'll show you in a second. Yeah.
I was wondering how do you know that there's not any of the signal?
Right. Okay. So fine. You run your simulation before, and you look at what would distinguish the signal from the backgrounds, and you put a cut where you think that there will be no signal.
Right.
Yeah. So this is an example, for instance. So what you have here, we were just discussing the PT of the lepton system, right? So the big green peak is the Drellian, so this is Z. So typically they go back to back, so they're not very boosted. At the bottom here, you have different colors for the signal in the various backgrounds. So the signal is in red here, and you see that compared to the other backgrounds, or most backgrounds, it's quite boosted, but not top. Top is actually has larger PTLL. But this is one of the selections. So you look at this and you think that, okay, I'm going to take away that peak by cutting here. And I'm not losing that much signal if I do that. I look at the mass of the two leptons. Again, it's relatively small. The Z, the Drellian, peaks at 90, as you would expect. And you see that the top background, which is has lots of energy, has a very long tail. And finally, the angle between the two leptons. You see there's a big difference here between Drellian and the other backgrounds. All right. So after you make these selections, then some of the smaller backgrounds become more important compared to...
The Drellian looks peak like around 50 GeV instead of 90. Do you know what that is?
Does it? This is for emu, yeah.
Oh,
so this is the decay to two taus, and then the leptonic decay of the taus. So you have, the original taus had all the momentum, but then you produce four neutrinos that you don't see. So it won't reconstruct at 90. Okay, so now even in your signal region, you can still play and divide your signal region into different purities. So this is the invariant mass. So we decided that we would cut below 50. But then we separate again between two different regions. Now this one is a little purer. It's not obvious, but it has less background and it actually has more signal. But the background composition is also different. So when you put everything into a big fit, you'll be able to reduce overall the uncertainties. The other thing that we can do is play with the subleading lepton momentum. So in the first versions of this analysis, we actually did not want to go very low in this lepton PT because we were scared of the fake backgrounds. You can see here, as a function of PT, the amount of fakes that you, this is MIS-ID, but also this background that we did not understand very well, gamma plus W plus gamma peaks at low momentum. So you really need to understand this very well if you want to do this. And so we stayed at higher PTs. However, there is signal there, and we want to get it. And so we subdivided, again, the various regions, signal regions, into bins of PT lepton. So this bin is dominated by missing fakes, and then it goes down, and then you see more top and more WW. Okay, so a word about the VBF topology. So like I said before, you fuse as two Zs or two Ws to produce a Higgs. When the incoming quark emits this W, quark gets a transverse momentum kick, but in general will continue in the forward-backward direction. So this is an actual event. It's a very nice event. So the signal to background here is pretty large. So this is likely a real Higgs. And you see that the two leptons, there's one electron and one muon. These are the muon chambers that are lit up. And this represents the shower of the electron. You see that the two are close together in space. The missing momentum is pointing in the opposite direction because in principle the neutrinos are going there. And you have the two forward jets, forward and backward. So this is the topology that you're after. So in this topology, again, you're looking for this angle between the two leptons that I mentioned before. But you're also looking at the separation in rapidity. So this is essentially the angle between the two jets, right? So this angle is large. Here it looks like almost 180 degrees. And so this is the difference in rapidity, which is linked to this angle cosine theta. You can look at the mass of the two jets. So this is the most efficient, I think, discriminator for the Higgs. You see that the mass, when you reconstruct the mass of the system of the two jets, it's very large. And again, when we do this, we separate in bins of MJJ. So in the event that we were seeing, we were in this region around over one TeV. So it's quite clean. So for this analysis, we use boosted decision trees. And boosted decision trees are essentially, we're almost doing it by hand in what I'm presenting to you. So what you do is you come up with a set of variables that can discriminate signal and background. And then you go through all those variables and you pick some value that is able to discriminate the best between your signal and background. So maybe your best variable is MLL, like we saw before. And then you play with the cut value. And based on some metric that you can vary in these constructions, then you come up with some kind of cut. Okay, so if this branch here will have more signal and this one will have more background. However, here you still have some signal, so you still want to work. And so you go through all your variables again, and you pick the best variable and the best cut. At some point you stop because maybe you run out of events, so you need a training set for this, like a Monte Carlo simulation, or because you've reached essentially no events anymore, or you've met some other criteria and you stop there. And the trees can be quite deep or quite shallow. And this allows you basically to select in multi-dimensional space in a very efficient way, distinguish signal from background. Because you're training on Monte Carlo, you need to believe what the Monte Carlo is doing. So you need to do lots of checks to make sure that it's okay. Now what the boosted does is that you have your training set. You have a training set of Monte Carlo events, and you have another testing set, if you will. So then you run your events in this decision tree, and some single events will end up here, because this one is never completely background anyway. And so what you do is you construct another tree, but you boost the value of these events, so that the decision tree will work harder to classify it better. And you can make, and you keep doing that, you can construct like a whole forest of trees, 1,000 trees. And in the end, you run your sample on all of them, and you produce some discriminant that is the average of all the outputs of whether this is a signal or a background. So if it's a background, you would give it, say, value -1, if you're almost sure that it is, and if it's signal, then it would be 1.
Yeah. do you choose which variable we touch at each time? So it's first one, let's say MLL, second one is BILL, whatever, you keep going?
Yeah, well, it could be MLL, 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 PTLL, MLL. So it considers at every branch, it considers all the variables.
Oh, I see. And it decides which one will be the best for that branch for that time.
Yeah. It scans all the variables and all the values for this variable. Okay, so this is what I described. So it's an automated cut sequence to optimize expected signal and background. And the output, if you're doing a boosted decision tree, is a forest of this decision trees. And the output would look like something like this, minus one, where you expect essentially almost no back, no signal, but a lot of background. And here you want something that looks as signal-like as possible. Now, interestingly, if you're trying to measure the VBF production process, then this Higgs production here becomes your background. So you're trying to get rid of it. So the minute we had some evidence for this, we were considering it as a background right away, which is kind of interesting when you look for it for so long. So this I mentioned, and the three rightmost bins are signal categories. So when we do reblind, for instance, these BDT distributions, we'll make sure that where we cut, there's very little signal. And we can look at the rest. So with our simulations and our normalizations that use data, we should be able to reproduce everything well until we get into the single region. If we can see that this looks okay, then we can unblind and look at the signal, like I discussed before.
Would it be possible to give a set of cuts to let us know what the PDT value was for each, or what the cuts were for each PDT value? Is that possible for each or something?
Yeah, so that's there. There are many multivariate techniques out there. And in fact, when in 2008 or 9, the collaboration was trying many of them. We did that also at previous colliders. But the BDTs are used, I don't know, maybe 80% of the time, 20% is maybe neural nets. And you have genetic algorithms and other things. But the reason why we like them is because they're pretty transparent, right? You can unpack your trees. It's a little difficult when you have 1,000 trees and you're boosting, but you can look at the trees and see what it's doing. So so what you can do is feed it a bunch of, if you've got a lot of Monte Carlo, is you look at the distributions. You don't want to feed it crap, variables that do not distinguish between signal and background. So you want some discrimination. You give it to this automated sequence, and it does a lot of work for you, right? Like you saw, we're basically doing by hand this boosted decision tree. We have categories, and then we go, okay, we still look, in the background rich to get more signal, and we separate again. So we're doing essentially the same thing, but this is automated, and it's very fast, and it's transparent.
But is it possible in the appendix of a paper or something to put VDT equals to 0.5 implies Z set of 10 cuts or something? And then VDT equals to 0.5.
No, it would be because of this, because of the boosted trees, the output, like I said, is the result of doing a sum over. So this would be one tree. The sum over, and these are leaves at the end. The sum over 1,000 of them, but you can make it manageable. I don't think you would put it in a paper, but you can look to understand. In fact, I mean, one reason why we're not using a BDT, most analyses use a BDT when they can, but we are not because we essentially did the work ourselves. So what you can do is run a BDT and see why, maybe you get an efficiency gain, a sensitivity gain of 30% over, your best guess at what would be the ideal analysis. And then you can unpack it and go in and figure out why, what did I not consider, what am I doing wrong, and then implement it by yourself. you'll probably get to within 5% of the full thing, is my guess. Neural nets are not, you would not understand what they're doing. And it's even worse now because I don't know if you've heard about deep learning. It's basically deep nets, so neural nets with many, many layers. You have no clue what it's doing. Here are some results. This is the BDT discriminant output and the transverse mass for three signal bins. So this is a bin number. It's not the actual output of the BDT itself. And our signal is this hatched, white and I guess red. And the other Higgs signal is, which is a background here, is in red. And you see that in the last bin, it becomes quite clean. This is for EMU, this is for EEMU. So there's not a lot of background left here. There's still some signal here that's competing with GGF. The cross-sections, if you remember, about the difference in cross-section is a factor of 10. GGF is 10 times larger. So you're fighting against that. So for the background estimation, we will use control regions. So this is illustrated here, and this would be the simplest case. If you've got some peaking signal and you want to calculate what is the background here, you can go in the sidebands and make a measurement. So this is what we do for the analysis with two photons. It's data-driven. We don't calculate a priori we have a calculation for what it should be, but we rely on the extrapolation from control regions to the signal region. So this is the ideal simplest case. In our case, it's a bit more difficult because we have many different backgrounds and they have different shapes and the signal doesn't peak like this. Okay. So this is an illustration of various control regions for a few backgrounds. So the WW control region, as you can see, you don't see any signal. So the Higgs would be in red here. So what we've picked is a region in MLL that is greater than where you expect the signal to peak. And then we can compare what we get from our calculations, our Monte Carlo simulation that is normalized to some calculations. And then we can normalize everything and also check for any shape differences and correct for them. Our top control region is one, you see that it's quite pure, is one where we identify a jet that is B-tagged. And then it's completely dominated by top events. And this one I'll discuss later, but we can also look at the background for same charge events. So if it's coming from a Higgs, which is neutral, the total charge should be zero. And here we're looking at the total charge of the two leptons to be +2 or -2. And so this will happen when you have these backgrounds, either the fakes or W gamma or W gamma star. So they are mostly charge symmetric, at least for W gamma and gamma star. And we can normalize them there. Okay, so this is, I won't go into the details, but it's a recap of all the backgrounds that we consider and what is the mechanisms, how we get to the final state, and what are the discriminants that we use to get rid of them. Some of that I haven't discussed are WZ and W gamma and gamma star. So what happens here is you have a W and a gamma. Like I said, the gamma hits some part of the detector. And normally you would see two electrons coming out, an electron and a positron, but sometimes you can lose one. And so you only have one electron. So this is a photon conversion. And so we can have a conversion veto. So if it was a photon, it will likely go through a few layers of our tracker without interacting. At some point it interacts, produces a track. And so we can make sure that it that we have a track with the very first layers of our silicon tracker. So this is a veto for conversion. And these I've discussed. Okay, so this is how our control regions work. So we have our signal here. This is an MLL, and it peaks below, say, 55. There's a bit of a residual signal here. And so what we do, we try to normalize our WW background, this thing in blue, in this region between 55 and 110. What we're trying to do is extrapolate from this region to this one. Okay, and this is illustrated here. We also have what we call a validation region. So after we look at this, we renormalize everything, and if we believe that we get this right, we should also get this right. Okay, so we try to validate this procedure. I think I'll skip this. So for the top background, what we do is we go into one jet. So you can either, when you veto any jet, you get this distribution. If you ask for one B tag, then it becomes yellow, which means it's very pure in top. However, you will need to extrapolate again between having seen a B jet and not seeing one. So there are systematics associated with all these extrapolations. So what are the systematics that we consider? So the kinematics, if you go from one region to the other, from this one to the other, you will have different scales as a systematics. So you have one calculation and you renormalize it, and you want to apply this normalization everywhere, but you can make a mistake. So we consider differences in scales and PDFs in the parton shower program that we use, and then in the underlying event. We check for the modeling and the shape. So we, from two different calculations, the shape could be, you know, it's one thing to normalize everything together, but the shape could vary. So we consider different calculations for this shape. And in the end, you get these numbers, which are relatively small. Okay, so for W plus jets, so these are our fake leptons. Like I said before, you will get those. Well, this is an illustration, for instance. You can say, perhaps, from a strange quark in the proton, you produce a W. You turn this one into a charm, and that charm can decay leptonically, so you have a legitimate lepton here. Could be a muon. Now, the fragmentation of this charm then, you know, means that you're kind of expecting some activity around the lepton, but occasionally, rarely, you will get essentially one leading lepton, and you don't see anything else around. And so, so what we do is in our signal prediction, is constructed by using a sample that has our control region, where we select events that have failed this selection. Okay, so maybe the muon was not very isolated, or maybe the muon was the impact parameter was a little large, so that it looks essentially like a fake. So we go and measure this in our sample. So you pass all the cuts except that something went wrong in the ID of the lepton. And then you need some type of transfer factor. So given, say, that I've seen 50 of those, that means that I would see how many identify. So you need some transfer factor. So for this, we go into another sample, either QCD-enriched data or Z plus jets. In fact, we use Z plus jets now, where we calculate this ratio, okay? So, and I think I have an illustration, maybe not. So what we would typically do is we would go and look for a Z instead here. So you have the two leptons. You can identify the the event quite well because the invariant mass will peak at 90 GeV. And this extra guy here will be a fake. And so you look at Z plus one jet events, and you count the number of well-identified leptons and IT-identified leptons, and you calculate your transfer factor from that sample. Now, there's a problem with that, as I'll show you after, is that there'll be some electroweak background, so real leptons that you need to subtract when you do that. Okay, and there's a... So the other thing we need to consider is that the flavor of the jet, the type of initial parton that started the whole thing, whether it's a light quark, a gluon, a bottom or a charm quark, will influence this transfer factor. So if you have a Z plus a jet or a W plus a jet, they're different. They will have different flavor composition. So you need to take this into account. In the past, we were using mostly just multi-jet data for the transfer factors, and there was a large difference between what we predicted, between the flavors of our signal and the sample. And so now we use Z plus jets, which is much closer, is a better analog to W plus jets. And so we use this, but still it's not perfect. And this is illustrated here in terms of the missing ID extrapolation factor for different production mechanisms. Okay, so opposite charge W plus jets MC should be our real background, okay? And Z plus jet MC, as you can see, they kind of track each other. So at least in a simulation, we think that these two are close. Now you can vary, you can look at same charge and vary all these things. Whoops. And determine a systematic uncertainty for all this. This is the problem that I mentioned before, is that if you have an anti-ID muon, you have very little background. So you basically have, this is for Z plus jets. You essentially have a clean Z plus jet sample. But if you ask that the muon be identified, then this is background from electroweak process. Typically it's W, Z production. So you have a Z and you have a W, so these are real muons. And you need to subtract this background for your transfer factors. And you see that it becomes a real problem at higher PT because, well, first of all, you have no fakes and it becomes all real. And we can use the QCD background at the higher PT. But then again, the fake background is very small, so it doesn't matter. Okay, so these were some examples of the systematics. Maybe in the next 5 minutes, I'll just go through the diboson backgrounds and then I'll be done. So, so what we call other dibosons is everything other than our dominant WW background. So WZ and the gamma star, W gamma here. And as I mentioned before, this is essentially you produce a lepton with the same or opposite charge as a W with equal probability for those dibosons. So we can normalize the non-WW using the same sign data. So this is our control region, essentially. So if you think it's going to be symmetric, then you have the shape. We also have for the NT distribution, but you also have the normalization. Now the problem or the difficulty is that you will get some missing mis-ID'd leptons. So these are fake leptons. And those are not charge symmetric. And so you need to take this background into account so properly and this asymmetry between the two. But everything that's underneath is should be symmetric. We also have validation regions for these processes. So for W gamma, we can have turn on the conversion, basically, flag, which means that you have a track that appears in the middle of the tracker, and it in the lower regions you don't see hits, and you see that the prediction and the data agree relatively well. And for W gamma star, so this is a virtual photon, so it produces two leptons, and so we look for two leptons coming from a point in space, and again, it's pretty clean and well measured. Yeah.
Why aren't the big leptons far symmetric?
Yeah.
That seems surprising.
Yeah, it's because of this guy. So we are colliding protons and protons. Yeah, and there's a charge correlation. But this was also a problem, sorry, at the Tevatron. So you have a charge correlation between the C or whatever quark that you produce in the lepton here. Well, just by charge conservation, right? So you come in with some quark, so this was charge minus one-third, and you need charge minus one-third at the end. And so the charge is correlated. Now, one diagram, but if you had W plus 10 jets, then the chances are that this would get diluted. So you don't always get the direct correspondence. But this, if you get this type of diagram, if this happened, then the correlation is very strong.
But C or C bar have the same probability as you miss tag with the lepton, right?
Yeah. 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 Okay, and then, okay, so these were our validation regions for the two processes, and then these are our same charge control regions where we do our normalizations for zero jet or one jet. Okay, so maybe a word on the Drellian background. So as you can see, the Drellian background is a production of a Z plus, say, jets. Or no jets. Now, if you have a perfect detector, this should be zero because you measure no missing transverse energy or no missing momentum. However, you can see this is a log scale, but you can see that there's quite a bit of a tail. So the measurement is not perfect. And so in this case, when we look for same flavor leptons, which is what you would get from a Z boson, you want to cut harder on missing transverse energy to try to get rid of everything. But we have other ways of getting rid of it. So we have the cut on PT of the LL, like we discussed, so you can get rid of a lot and the angle between the two. And we can use also control regions where we measure the normalization here, and then we extrapolate the other regions. Okay, so last slide. I'll just flash the results since we've been discussing this. But so in the end, in this particular channel, we observed an excess of 6.1 sigma, where 5.8 was expected. So we're measuring something that's quite close to what we expected. For the VBF channel, we have a 3 sigma excess. And 2.7 expected. When we do a global fit of everything, this mu represents the signal strength, where one would be the standard model, two would be that you measured twice what the standard model predicted. So you see that we are 8% high within about 20% with the two uncertainties added in quadrature. And this turns out to be the most precise value that we get of all of our channels. It's by far, as you can see, not the cleanest channel, but other more clean channel like ZZ do not have the statistics. So they will take over in run two in terms of the precision. But in run one, this was our most precise channel. So I think I'll stop here. I noticed, Cliff, that I had 2 hours, but I'm basically prepared.
My schedule is a mystery.
Okay.
So you would stop on the way, you should stop on the natural places.
Yeah, okay, good. So, any questions? Yes.
Is it possible? possible to ever think about measuring the charge of the jet? I mean, I know there are complications with it, but is that a thing that you ever think about?
Yeah, we've done it.
Oh, it's,
yeah.
Is it done right now?
We're not using it in our Higgs analyses, but we did it, for instance, at the Tevatron. Yeah. Ideally, you want to, the cleaner the environment, the easier it is. So you can associate all the charged tracks to one vertex. It's done. When taus decay, they produce what looks like a jet. We do count the charges then as well. Yeah.
So is this for non-V jets, the charge identification? I know there's a V jet algorithm, but is it also for that?
Well, the main example, I don't think we're using jet charge for identification of B jets. For B jets, we have a multivariate discriminant, but the thing that works the best is identifying a secondary vertex or displaced secondary vertex. But in the example that I mentioned for when we look at taus that typically decay into what looks like a narrow jet because you can produce pions and rows, and we want to distinguish between taus and jets, so those could be collimated jets, then we do look at the jet charge, so the charges of all the particles in a collimated cone. And that it's useful for that. Yeah.
The lighting procedure that you mm-hmm. how commonly used is that in general? Experimental.
For the Higgs analyses, I'm trying to think if we did not use it. For all the measurements, the Higgs measurements at 125, I think there's no exception. We blinded everywhere.
I mean, just in general. I've never heard of blinding procedures like that in physics. That's something.
Oh, yeah?
Blinding in general is something
It's commonly used in CMS and Atlas. We did not use it much 10 years ago, CDF and D0. There are some analyses that we did blinded that, I worked on the first top cross-section measurement for run 2, and that we blinded at CDF. Ideally, you want to blind yourself, but most of our searches are blinded. I mentioned at the beginning that this search was not blinded when we were searching over a wide mass range. We had no sensitivity, and to blind, you need to define what your signal region is. If your signal can be anywhere over a wide mass range, then it's difficult. You know, you can blind between here and here, but you're. And it's also, I should say, it's the problem with these control regions, right? So we assume when we normalize like this that there's no new physics that's polluting your control region, and that could definitely be wrong. So if then you're increasing your background sort of artificially. And, but it could happen.
So that 6.1 sigma, that's for all production modes?
Yeah. I think, yes, it is.
Okay.
I'm not sure if it includes VH. So I'll have it for you tomorrow.
Are they expecting to get over 5 sigma in run 2 for vector boson fusion? You know?
Yes, we will. What we're doing right now, the results are not out, but we're also combining with the CMS.
All right.
So they don't have us. So this is just one channel. But another strong channel is tau tau, VBF and tau tau, and gamma gamma. And we'll see what we get with CMS, but it's going to be pretty significant.
How much more complicated is that process of combining two experiments together than just sort of doing the analysis on one?
I would say it's easier. These are the big fit that takes all of the channels is a monster fit. It has like 200. These systematics are nuisance parameters. Things there are thousands of them, and things there's crosstalk between this signal is a background in another area, and your systematic uncertainty on the signal is correlated. There are things that are not correlated. You need to go through all of this. When we combine with the other experiment, at some point it becomes so complicated that we simplify it a lot. So, I mean, all the things that really matter, that make a significant difference, we need to treat. But what we find at the end of this process, which actually takes months, is that we could have done it much more quickly. It's just that we need to make sure, we think it's small, we need to show it's small. When we combine with the other experiment, the signal systematics are correlated, but most of the experimental systematics are not, because there are different detectors. There are a few other things that the PDFs for some backgrounds are correlated. But it's still a massive fit because you're, for tomorrow I'll have the table of all the production modes and all the decay modes, and we do searches and all and measurements in all of them, and you have another experiment, and you're combining all of this, and you're extracting information from correlated information from all the measurements. But this is the topic for tomorrow. Any other questions? Yeah.
A bit of a different question, but how's the LHC running? Like, is it like being as expected?
It's a little slow.
Oh, it's slower than
they're a bit late, and maybe we have. And they've had issues with. they call it a mouse or a rat, and there's something somewhere in the beam. There's some deposit or something there. And they have to steer around this thing. And the amount of luminosity delivered up until now is of order of 40 inverse picobarns, which isn't much, right? So it's 1,000 of. We're sensitive right now with that data set for things that are very heavy already, because you don't need much luminosity. And the first results will be presented in 2 weeks at EPS. So if you want to know if we've produced black holes, yeah.
we know you haven't, because the Earth didn't get
eaten. Yeah, yeah. Oh, you're interested in diejets. No? You're
in everything.
Yeah. In everything.
Tell us all the things you've done.
I haven't looked at the diejets yet, but we will have them in 2 weeks, at least for this data set. We were, I think, expecting by the end of July maybe one inverse femtobarn, so a lot more. But in general, the accelerators, they start slow and then they go fast. They are considering shortening the heavy ion running period at the end of the year, maybe to get a little bit more proton collisions. I'm quite optimistic for next year. I think next year will be quite productive. We haven't made the switch from 50 nanoseconds to 25 nanoseconds, so we'll see how that goes. But I'm confident that they will get there. So, you know, a few months and in a few years is okay.
For these summer conferences, there's been enough time to do an analysis, so you're going to present new things, but run two things.
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty tight, but I did the diejet I did in run one, and we added data up to the last minute. You can't do an analysis like that. There's just no way. But diejets is straightforward. You know, it's falling distributions. You're looking for a significant deviation or some bump, and this they're ready to do, and we did it. We did it with 300 inverse nanobarns. So we had better limits than the Tevatron, which had 100,000 more times the luminosity when the accelerator started.
Are you kidding about mouse?
Hmm?
The mouse?
They call it the Mulot in French, the engineers. They don't know what it is. There's something that's dropping. So they call them UFOs, unidentified flying objects. That hit the beam, and there appears to be some type of deposit, and they need to. And the beam pipe is not very big, And so they need to steer the beam around it. And that might limit the luminosity or the number of bunches that they can put in there.
And just fry it or something?
Yeah, yeah. Well, in principle, they've been frying it because part of the when you try to get a good vacuum, I think I mentioned this yesterday, but you scrub the beam pipe, so you blow up the size of the beam, and then you try to knock the gas molecules that are just sticking and waiting to get into the beam pipe, try to get them out. And so, in principle, it's been fried, certainly dead. But I don't think they could steer the beam through it. That could be a bit dangerous. Yeah. I think the full, it's like a stick of dynamite. If you steered the beam into the concrete or just the rock, it would be like a stick of dynamite. So you need to be careful with that beam. But they did something that was very scary also. So they had trouble ramping up the magnets at the beginning of the year. And so they need to... So a superconducting magnet, for reasons I don't understand, but if you... So when it's superconducting, you can make it quench, like become non-superconducting. You know, if you perturb it, if you hit it, or put some energy into it, it becomes non, and then it quenches. So all of a sudden, it's not superconducting. So you go through these cycles, and you're able to put more current each time. So they start, you know, all the 1,200 magnets went through this cycle where you ramp up the current until they become non-superconducting, and then you try again, and you get to a higher current and a higher current. And there was one sector that just didn't want, you know, was flattening out. And they could not, and that was important because we wanted to go to 13 TeV, not be stuck at 11.5 or 12. And they found out that there was some type of short to ground, and so that was causing a problem. Interestingly, you can run the superconductor shorted to ground because it's a superconductor, so it has no resistance. So you know, even if you've got a big rod of copper, this is infinite. And I learned that we were actually running one of our big toroid magnets this way. We had a short, but once they're superconducting, you don't care. But this was a problem for when the magnet quenches, so it's kind of dangerous. So what they did is there's a lot of current in these superconducting magnets, and they decided to make it go through the short to fry it. And something like this happened when it blew up, right? So there was a lot of current. You're supposed to get that current out quickly because or else you generate too much heat, and then the helium wants to get out. And so this was part of the repairs, was to make sure that we can get the current out. And so when they said, we'll just fry it with the current from the magnet, that was scary. But it worked. They did fry it.
Whatever it was, it evaporated.
Yeah.
It's like the equivalent of just hitting with a hammer or something.
Yeah. They said, we'll just go with 1,000 amps. And if you mess up, it might be just one magnet, but you need to cool it, right? So now it's at minus, basically at absolute zero. You need to warm it up, you need to take it up, bring a new one, cool it. So it's quite a delay. You need to repump the air out. So it's months. Okay.
So, another question? Sounds like we'll have a little bit longer lunch break. Maybe okay. They won't be ready for you till 1, but if you want to go early, they may be ready for you. But by 1, they should be ready for you. So we'll see you at 2:30.
Okay.